Wow. Well, it is such a great honor to be here with all of you, to be here back at Town Hall, to be celebrating KBCS and the wonderful work that your community radio station does. Do not take it for granted. KBCS has now just bought a new antenna, which will extend its reach to have a 40% larger audience, which is thrilling, heading up to Spokane. To be a part of that essential, well, I see it as a kitchen table. I see the media as a kitchen table that stretches across the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day, war and peace, life and death. And anything less than that is a disservice to the servicemen and women of this country, especially on this 11th anniversary of the longest war in U.S. history, the war in Afghanistan. They can't have these debates on military bases. They rely on us in civilian society to have the discussions that lead to the decisions about whether they will live or die, whether they will be sent to kill or be killed. Anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society. Democracy Now! Started, 16 years ago as the only daily election show in public broadcasting on a few dozen community radio stations. We thought we'd only go until the election. And now, 16 years later, we're broadcasting on over 1,100 public radio and television stations. Around the country and around the world, there is a hunger for independent, authentic voices. Instead of what you get on the networks, that small circle of pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. This trip has been amazing. As Dennis said, you know, it's a 100-city tour. We're somewhere in the 60s there. And the other day someone asked me, you know, what city are you at? I said, I think it's 60. And they said, you only have 40 more to go? I found that a very negative comment. The first station we did a fundraiser for was WSLR in Sarasota, Florida. WSLR. We were about 20 minutes late. We'd just come from the Republican convention. And I said to Dennis, oh, my gosh, bye. At this rate, the first station, 20 minutes late, by the 100th city, we will be months late. We didn't do too bad today, although I don't know how you guys do it. Driving from Olympia here, what should have been, an hour, became 3.5 hours. My God, talking about a large parking lot. But the trip, the journey has been remarkable. One of the places we went to before the first presidential debate was Blacksburg, Virginia, Virginia Tech, where we spoke to Colin Goddard. He's one of the survivors of the Virginia Tech massacre that took place in 2007. He came down to back to his alma mater when we were there, and he showed us Norris Hall, which was the site of the worst part of the massacre. He was shot 4 times. In his hips and in his shoulders, and he took me through the cinder block tiled floor hallway of the typical college building. And then we came on the walkway, which was where the killings took place, and they've now turned it into a center for peace and nonviolence and taken away the numbers on the room where he had taken his French class. He wasn't going to go to class that day. He was going to go to breakfast instead with his friend. But then his conscience got the better of him. And as usual, he was late to class, but he did get in. His French professor rolled her eyes because there was Colin rolling in late. But there was a student later than him, and it was Karen, who was the most, who was the best student in the class. He'd never beat her to class. She was frazzled. She said that the authorities had kept her in her dorm because there had been a shooting in the dorm earlier in the morning, and they were all shocked. They said, shooting? What are you talking about? Then they heard this fast snap, snap, snap of bullets, but they didn't know it was that. They thought it was maybe construction outside, but then it came closer, and the French professor looked out the door and turned back and said to the class, jump under your desks now, and she was shot and killed. And Colin was under his desk. He pulled out his Nextel phone. He said he had never done this before. Called 911 on his phone. He said, quick, Norris Hall, there's been a shooting. And they said, Norris Hall, where's that? And he said, Norris Hall, Virginia Tech, where's that? He said, Virginia Tech, Blacksburg, Blacksburg? He said, Virginia Tech, Blacksburg, Virginia, Virginia? He didn't know where he was calling when he called 911. And somehow the phone got knocked out of his hand, and he later learned that the young woman on the desk, under the desk next to him, had grabbed it and was then narrating to the authorities somehow she had made it through what was taking place. And he saw the camouflage pants of the shooter come in. And that's when he felt the pain in his own body. But he was lucky, though you can't call it lucky, because there were 16 people in his classroom, including his professor. Only 7 survived. But then, before I spoke to Colin, I talked to Nikki Giovanni, the great poet, and I went to her office, the university distinguished poet professor. And she was full of beans. She was so excited because, well, just about now at Virginia Tech, she was planning a big celebration of Toni Morrison, her friend. She lost her son, Slade, who Toni Morrison had dedicated Sula to. And so she just wanted to make Toni Morrison happy. She wanted to celebrate her life, even as she mourned the death of her son. And she said, so me and Doc, she was making phone calls as we were setting up the camera. She said, me and Doc, prepare the celebration. I said, who's Doc? She said, Dr. Maya Angelou. So can you imagine together in the big auditorium at Virginia Tech taking place just about now, Maya Angelou and Nikki Giovanni and Toni Morrison. So she was excited. We talked about her poetry, her craft, her activism. And I knew she didn't like to talk about the shooting. But, you know, there's something so intimate about appropriate technology, radio and television. Not the satellite studios, but being, well, Virginia Woolf described it well, you know, in a room of one's own. And there Professor Giovanni was, and I asked her, and she said, well, you know, I was in San Francisco right before the shooting. And she said, I just felt something, and I was there for a meeting. I said, I'm leaving. And they said, but you just got here. She said, I know, I'm going home. She didn't know what was going to take place. It didn't happen yet. And she flew home, and when she landed in Virginia, she was racing to the Blacksburg exit in her car, but there was a TV broadcast car that was racing 120 miles an hour past her. And she thought something's happened. She turned on the radio, and she heard the news that there had been a massacre. She saw the police at the Blacksburg exit. She wasn't able to pull off there, and she said, it's Joe. It's Joe, her poetry student. She had taught the shooter poetry. And she had described him as mean and menacing. In the class, he wore sunglasses, wore a hat over his face. She couldn't reach him. I mean, she had taught many difficult students, kids with autism, kids with Tourette's. That wasn't the issue. She even felt challenged and invigorated. She was a teacher, after all. She is a professor. But she said she could not reach this young man, and she was scared of him. And she said, I want you out of my class. He said, you can't make me. She said, you're right. If you don't leave, I quit. And she told that to her heads of the department. This was a year before the shooting. He went on to stalk and harass young women on campus. He was institutionalized. How is it conceivable that he could legally get a gun? And that's why Colin Goddard was there. Colin was extremely compassionate about Joe. Said, how is it he didn't get help? How is it every red flag that could have gone up went up? This wasn't a person who just snapped. Everyone knew he was trouble. How could he legally get a gun? And that's why Colin Goddard is devoting his life now. He's in Washington at the Brady Campaign Against Gun Violence, you know, founded by Jim Brady, the press secretary of President Ronald Reagan. With the attempted assassination of President Reagan, Jim Brady was shot through the head, and he and his wife, Sarah, set up the Brady Campaign. And they have led, with Colin, a campaign to get the presidential debate moderators to ask a question about gun violence, especially the first presidential debate that was taking place at the University of Denver. I mean, Denver Colorado, down the road from Aurora, just a few months before the killings at the movie theater and a decade ago, Columbine. Why would it be so tough? They got tens of thousands of names, but Jim Lehrer, the PBS moderator of the first debate, ultimately didn't ask that question. Though in the second debate, the town hall debate in Hofstra University, it wasn't one of the moderators. It was one of the regular people who asked a question about gun violence. And this goes to an issue larger than gun violence, but to who controls the democratic and electoral process. Who are the forces and the powers that be, for example, going to the issue of the power of the National Rifle Association. So we went from Blacksburg, Virginia, and I encourage you to watch that amazing show with Professor Giovanni and Colin Goddard. We flew to Denver because we were going to cover the debate. We were going to broadcast the debate, and that's just what we did. You know, it took place at the University of Denver, so we set up just down the road in Littleton at a Comcast facility. We went online that day, and we looked up, well, how the workers were decorating the set because we wanted ours to look just like theirs. And we saw the bright blue backdrop with the writing, and Democracy Now!'s backdrop says democracynow.org all over. It looked perfect. We set it up. And then we saw that they had these podiums. And so we went out and rented podiums that looked kind of like the presidential debate podiums. I want to thank Brenda Murad, my colleague, who was dressing it up through the day. The Comcast workers got so into this. And why were we doing this? We were expanding the debate. We invited the third party presidential candidates to participate in the debate. How is it that the debates have gotten so narrow? Do you remember decades ago, or for young people, you remember reading about it in the history books when the League of Women Voters used to control the debates? A truly independent body? And then in the 1980s, somehow the control of these debates, after they included a third-party presidential candidate in one of them, and just got wrested from the ladies, right, and given to the big boys, to the major political parties. They took over the debate. Most people don't know this. You think that it's run by this independent commission on presidential debates, the CPD. Sounds sort of governmental body or an independent body. It's run by the two parties. What happened to the league is the two parties handed them a 12-page secret contract and said, you've got to sign this. They said, we will not only not sign that, but they held a news conference and released the secret contract to the public. And that was the end of them. So the two parties took over. Frank Farrakhan was the head of the Republican Party at the time. He headed the Republican side. He still does. And Paul Kirk, head of the Democratic Party at the time, he headed it then. Now it's Mike McCurry, the former press secretary for Bill Clinton, who's one of the chief lobbyists for the telecoms in this country. He runs the Democratic side. This is such a good bet for the two parties to keep out all the others. And Frank Farrakhan appreciates a good bet because he is the executive director of the American Gaming Association. He's the chief lobbyist for gambling in this country. That's who runs the debates. And multi-page secret contracts are signed. We usually don't know what they are. This year, Time magazine got a hold of one and released it right before the last debate. And this private corporation is funded by private corporations like, Anheuser-Busch funds the debates. The International Bottled Water Association funds the debates. But interestingly, a big citizens movement is challenging this and trying to wrest back control of the debates. And this year, in the last month or two, the YWCA has pulled out from supporting these debates. Phillips North America has pulled out of supporting these debates. So when we were setting up our debate studio to be parallel to the one at University of Denver, I wasn't sure whether we should put Bud Light on the podiums or should it be bottled water. We couldn't decide. But we did know we were having the third-party candidates, and we had Dr. Jill Stein, the presidential candidate of the Green Party. We had Rocky Anderson, the presidential candidate of the Justice Party, the former mayor of Salt Lake City. We invited Gary Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, who's the Libertarian candidate, but he declined. So we had the two podiums just like they had the two podiums. And that night we began our broadcast, and it was broadcasting on PBS stations. Democracy Now! Now broadcasts on scores of PBS stations, some of the largest in the country, like KQED in San Francisco, runs us a number of times a day. We just went on the Howard University PBS station in Washington. And we're broadcasting throughout the country on every level of public media, and of course at democracynow.org. So the debate began, and Jim Lehrer, the moderator of the debate and the PBS NewsHour anchor, welcomed everyone to the University of Denver. And I think he said that President Obama won the coin toss, so he would answer the first question on the economy. He said, "President Obama, you have 2 minutes." And President Obama spoke, and then Mitt Romney spoke for 2 minutes, and then we paused the videotape. And I said, "Dr. Jill Stein, you have 2 minutes on the economy." And after her, Rocky Anderson, 2 minutes on the economy. And at the end of that, back to my colleague, Jim Lehrer at the University of Denver. And that's what the debate, that's how we expanded the debate. That's what democracy sounds like. And why is it so important? Well, how is it that climate change was not raised by the presidential candidates? And when they addressed the issue of foreign policy, the last debate, the one they had in Boca Raton, we were broadcasting from San Rafael, California, from the Marin Osher Jewish Community Center, and the place was packed with folks who come to the community center there. In front and center, in the front row was Hank. He turns 105 on November 20th. Big Democracy Now! Fan. He works out at the community center 3 times a week and drives himself home and back and to the center. Rocky Anderson and Jill Stein came to that debate as well, and we sat at a table because they sat at a table in Boca Raton. They raised the issue of climate change in every debate, and they raised the issue of drones. Now, the presidential candidates of the major party did get asked about drones, but they don't disagree. And that's very significant. Because I really think that most people in this country on many different issues are outside the consensus in Washington. People talk about gridlock and the bickering that takes place in Washington being the problem today for this country. I don't think the issue is partisan bickering and gridlock. I think it's the bipartisan consensus on all of these... On many of these critical issues, it's why we called our book The Silenced Majority. Because I really do think that those who are concerned about war in this country, those who are concerned about the growing inequality, those who are concerned about climate change, about the extreme weather from Washington to New York, the drenching rains in Florida, the Dust Bowl conditions of the Midwest, the fires from Washington to California to Colorado. Those who are concerned about the fate of the planet are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take it back. And so we went from the debate at the University of Denver to Colorado Springs because it was the eve of the 11th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan. And Colorado Springs is a heavily militarized city. You know, it's got Fort Carson, it's got NORAD, it's got the Air Force Academy. And we broadcast from the Tim Gill Center for Public Media, which is run by Rocky Mountain PBS. It had just been opened. And we brought in Dave Phillips. He was nominated for a Pulitzer for a series in the Colorado Springs Gazette about a unit that called itself Lethal Warriors. They went to Iraq, they came back, they went back to Iraq for another tour of duty, they came back, and they just didn't know how to turn off the kill switch. And they were killing their girlfriends, they were killing their wives, they were killing other soldiers, they were killing strangers in the streets. The murder rate in Fort Carson, 114 times out of surrounding Colorado Springs. You could only imagine what they were doing in Iraq. And then we had on a man named Andrew Pagani. He's a veteran. He also served in Iraq, but he's counseling soldiers and veterans now. His experience in Iraq had happened within the first few days of arriving. He was taking Larium, the anti-malaria drug, and he was hallucinating, and he saw, but actually did see, a Bradley tank explode in Iraqi, and he just completely fell apart. Emotional, mental breakdown, appealed to his commanding officer for help. Instead, he became the first soldier since the Vietnam War to be charged with cowardice. Do you know what a soldier faces when charged with cowardice? The death penalty. We then headed back from that broadcast to Denver because I was invited by Al Jazeera English to debate David Weston, the former president of ABC World News Tonight. So I was in the PBS NewsHour studios in Denver. And David Weston was in New York, and Shahab, the moderator, was in Washington. And he was asking us about the war and elections and the media's coverage. And, you know, I talked about what we did, expanding the debates, and David Weston said he felt that the media did do a good job in raising the issues and around elections and war. And I said, I beg to differ. And I referred him back to the 6 weeks before the invasion of Iraq, and remember, March 19th, 2003. 3 days before, March 16th, 2003, Rachel Corrie was killed in Gaza, in Rafah, when she was trying to defend a Palestinian pharmacist's home from an Israeli military bulldozer, and it crushed her to death. 3 days later, the U.S. would attack Iraq. So I talked about the 6 weeks before this, when Colin Powell, General Colin Powell, then the Secretary of State, gave his push for war at the United Nations. You know, he was considered very credible because he didn't immediately buy the WMD argument. You know, this is at a time when half the population was opposed to war. But when Secretary of State Powell gave his speech, he said the evidence was in. And this was the final nail in the coffin for so many. February 5th, 2003. So FAIR, the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org, did a study of the 2 weeks around Powell's address at the UN. And they looked at the four major nightly newscasts, the NBC Nightly News, the CBS Evening News, the PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, and the ABC World News Tonight, David Weston's organization. And they looked at this two-week period of the four nightly newscasts. There were 393 interviews done around war. Guess how many were with anti-war leaders? Three. Three of almost 400. When half the population was opposed to war. That is no longer a mainstream media. That's an extreme media beating the drums for war. That's what I said to David Weston. And he replied, Amy, it may surprise you to know that I agree with you. And I was very surprised. You know, he was in charge of the ABC World News that time. He said he will forever regret that Peter Jennings, who was the news anchor, you know, died of lung cancer, did not buy the weapons of mass destruction argument. But he prevailed on him, Weston did, to hold back, not to move forward with that, not to make that public. And David Weston said, I was under a lot of pressure. This is why we need independent media in this country. We then went from Colorado to New Mexico and broadcast from Los Alamos, from the birthplace of the nuclear age, from Fuller Lodge. Fuller Lodge was built in 1928 as an elite boys' school, and a very disgruntled young man named Gore Vidal went to school there and hated it. And then in 1943, it was taken over by the U.S. military, by the U.S. government, to bring in scientists for the top secret Manhattan Project to develop the atomic bombs that would later be dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is where the scientists first lived. That's where we broadcast from. You know, where people like J. Robert Oppenheimer from UC Berkeley, that's where they first came. J. Robert Oppenheimer, who would later say, quoting the Bhagavad Gita, I am the shatterer of worlds. Back in World War II, the Secretary of War was Henry Stimson. He was handed a list of possible targets to drop the first bombs on, the uranium bomb and the plutonium bomb. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Kyoto. He said, we're going to cross off Kyoto. Why? Because he and Mrs. Stimson had visited Kyoto. It was a beautiful city, the food delicious, the people wonderful, the art magnificent. He didn't want to destroy the city. If only the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki had been lucky enough to host the Stimsons. But the point is profound. He didn't want to destroy the city because he had come to know it. That's the power of independent media. How do we learn about the rest of the world? Through our friends, our family, maybe someone comes from another place, but much more often we learn about it through the media. And it is so important that that education, that knowledge comes from something other than a corporate lens. And in terms of our national security, perhaps even more important that the rest of the world learns about us through a lens and a microphone, not brought to you by the weapons manufacturers when we're all discussing war, not brought to you by the insurance industry and big pharma, the drug companies, when we're talking about health care, not brought to you by the oil and the gas and the coal and the nuclear companies when we're talking about climate change, or perhaps we won't talk about climate change, but brought to you by listeners and viewers like you. Secretary Stimson did not want to destroy Kyoto because he knew it. We need a media that allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear a Palestinian child or an Israeli grandmother, or if only you could hear Rachel Corey in her own words today, when you hear an aunt in Afghanistan, an uncle in Iraq, it breaks down bigotry. It breaks down caricatures that fuel the hate groups. You know, it's the reason Pacifica was founded more than 60 years ago. Pacifica in Berkeley, California. Founded by a war resister. After World War II, Lou Hill came out of the detention camps and said, there's got to be a media outlet not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. That's how Pacifica was founded. Not run by corporations, George Gerbner said, the late dean at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania, said, not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell that are raising our children today. First station, KPFA in Berkeley, 1949. Second station, 1959, KPFK in Los Angeles. We were just celebrating KPFK Friday night and Sunday night, KPFA in Oakland. And not run by corporations that profit from where? The third station, WBAI, my station in New York. The fourth station, KPFT in Houston. The fifth station, WPFW in Washington. That's the family of five Pacifica stations. KPFT in Houston went on the air in 1970 in the spring. Within weeks, it was blown off the air by the Ku Klux Klan. They strapped dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blew it to smithereens. And when they got back on their feet, when they rebuilt their transmitter and started broadcasting again, it was right in the middle of Orlo Guthrie singing Alice's Restaurant when they blew it up again. And I don't know if it was the Grand Dragon or the Exalted Cyclops or the Imperial Wizard, because I often confuse their titles, but he said it was his proudest act, I think, because he understood how dangerous Pacifica is, how dangerous independent media is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves.